This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Well, I'll tell you, the state partnership program, we have 13 nations partnering with 11 states. We partner now to do different things like medical training. We also do disaster relief partnerships, building the non-commissioned officer corps, poaching, interdiction.
That's Command Sergeant Major Christopher Kepner, a senior enlisted advisor of the National Guard, speaking on the state partnership program's goals on the continent. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also, the Trump administration unveils a new strategy for Africa that's focused on countering Chinese and Russian influence. Somalia's president and Eritrea's president wrap up a two-day consultation meeting in Mogadishu. And Zimbabwe's ruling party looks to endorse Emmerson Mnangagwa as its presidential candidate in 2023. We'll have these stories and more all ahead on Africa News Tonight. The Trump administration has unveiled a new strategy for Africa that's focused on countering Chinese and Russian influence on the resource-rich continent, and the administration is demanding more accountability for American aid. Patsy Wadzureswara has more from the White House.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has long been courting African leaders at events like September's China-Africa Forum. Chinese-funded infrastructure projects are popping up all over Africa. At the conservative-leaning think tank, the Heritage Foundation, the administration launched a new strategy on Africa.
Well, Kim, thanks very much.
Officials say it's designed to counter China's growing power, as well as Russia's attempts to increase its influence in the resource-rich continent. The strategy was revealed by National Security Advisor John Bolton.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Bolton said the goal of the strategy is to advance trade and commercial ties, counter the threat of terrorism, and ensure accountability for American aid. David Gicheru is the Deputy Chief of Mission from the Embassy of Kenya in Washington.
We had the speech. We'll take a look at the speech and look at the detail of the speech, and we'll give a comment later on that. But we are happy to understand that finally America has a strategy that is purposeful towards Africa.
The new Africa strategy is in line with the Trump administration's foreign policy that portrays China as a strategic competitor. Some analysts see the us-versus-them approach as counterproductive, including Mike Fuchs from the left-leaning Center for American Progress.
Which we should be creating partnerships with countries in Africa based on our interests and how we can work together to pursue shared interests. This is not, again, a battleground between the United States and China, but framing it that way is going to, I think, leave a bad taste in the mouth probably of a lot of the leaders and the people, frankly, in Africa.
Bolton also warned the U.S. will reevaluate its support for U.N. peacekeeping missions. Again, John Bolton.
We will seek to streamline, reconfigure, or terminate missions that are unable to meet their own mandate or facilitate lasting peace. Our objective is to resolve conflicts, not freeze them in perpetuity.
The U.S. will also review aid to countries whose governance it finds unaccountable. Bolton singled out South Sudan, signaling that all aid may soon end for the war-torn country. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Thank you, Patsy. And for more insight on President Trump's new strategy, VOA's Salem Solomon looks at what it means for Africa's interests.
The United States has unveiled a new Africa strategy designed to prioritize American interests and challenge efforts by China and Russia to develop economic, political, and security partnerships across the continent. The result is a strategy that emphasizes American needs and bilateral relationships while downplaying African concerns, says Jennifer Cook, the director of George Washington University's Institute for African Studies.
This sounds like a real return to the policies of realpolitik during the Cold War, when allies were based on their opposition to communism or the Soviet Union rather than good governance, human rights, economic prosperity, and so forth.
Bolton mentioned China at least 15 times in his speech at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative Washington, D.C.-based think tank. Bolton had pointed criticism for Beijing.
China uses bribes, opaque agreements, and the strategic use of debt to hold states in Africa captive to Beijing's wishes and demands.
He cited debt concerns in Zambia and Djibouti, a new Chinese military base in Djibouti, allegations that China fired lasers at American pilots, and concerns that Djibouti might hand a strategic port over to Chinese companies. Bolton painted Moscow in similar negative terms, describing a government concerned only with self-interest.
Russia advances its political and economic relationships with little regard to the rule of law or accountable and transparent governance.
The Trump administration sees in its new strategy a sharpened focus that will deliver results, but framing the dynamics in Africa too narrowly could undermine both U.S. and African interests, says Judd Devermont, the director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
When you don't see the bigger chessboard, you actually miss opportunities to advance U.S. interests and to improve African prosperity.
The new policy doesn't acknowledge many of the global players jockeying in Africa. India, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, all of them, Bolton left out of his remarks, have made significant investments in Africa from the Horn to Johannesburg.
They're major players putting lots of money and advancing their goals, and we lack from this administration how they're going to navigate that.
Bolton also spoke of mutual respect, African agency, and self-reliance, but how the United States will navigate relationships with African countries with extensive ties to either Beijing or Moscow is not really clear. But Bolton was firm that the U.S. should not assist nations working against its interests.
Countries that repeatedly vote against the United States in international forums or take actions counter to U.S. interests should not receive generous American foreign aid.
Cook worries that only investing in countries in close alignment with U.S. interests will produce short-term gains at a long-term cost.
My sense was that the administration will be looking for partners who support the U.S. contra other great powers.
I'm Salem Solomon for VOA News, Washington, D.C.
This year marks the 25th anniversary of the National Guard's State Partnership Program, where U.S. states and territories are matched with nations across the globe to grow their military and government capabilities. 81 nations are partnered with National Guard troops, many of which are in Africa. Our Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb, sat down with Command Sergeant Major Christopher Kerpner, the senior enlisted advisor of the National Guard, to talk about the State Partnership Program's goals on the continent and what's next for the National Guard in Africa.
Well, I'll tell you, the State Partnership Program, we have 13 nations partnering with 11 states. We partner now to do different things like medical training. We also do disaster relief partnerships, building the non-commissioned officer corps, poaching, interdiction. Really, whatever a nation might need, we try to bring that capability and tailor what they're looking for to help them build that security within their own nation.
Counter-poaching, what benefit does that bring to the countries?
Oh, well, when you have that poaching that goes on inside of those countries, it affects the economy. It's illegal activity. It's also can be assigned to the nation that there's not the rule of law. And so those kinds of things are very, very important to help that nation provide security within its own borders.
Why should Africans not be nervous about these partnerships?
Because these partnerships are really designed to help them bring what they need to help them have security within their individual countries. So it's really not an American solution coming in to fix all of their problems. It's about augmenting these nations to help them become stronger.
You look at Africa Command's website and you look at the number of activities going on in Africa, and there seems to be more and more every year.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about why that is, why Africa is gaining importance with the United States.
Africa is a very, very important continent. And really, if you look at our national defense strategy, you know, one of our main lines of effort is to strengthen partnerships and allies. And that fits right in with the continent of Africa and those nations on the continent of Africa to help them be security providers throughout the world and not security consumers.
How does a hurricane in one state affect its ability to get out and work these partnerships?
Yeah. So I have to tell you, and so not only with hurricanes, keep in mind for the last 15 years of war, we have been globally deployed supporting that fight as well. But to get to your question about how do we do that, we're 450,000 strong with Army and Air National Guardsmen. And when you have a state partnership, you just don't have access to that state. You have access to the entire capability of the National Guard.
Do we still have a light footprint in Africa, or have we increased our footprint?
So I'll tell you this, from a state partnership program perspective and a National Guard perspective, we are increasing our footprint from the perspective of we have two more countries right now that are going through the process, not approved yet, but are going through the process to see if we are going to have partnerships with them. So the state partnership program, I can say confidently, is growing in the continent of Africa.
And the two states that would be partnered with those countries, I know you can't name the countries, but what two states are looking at being added on?
Can't name those either because it's still going through the staffing process.
Okay, fair enough, sir. And then my final would be, because of this increased footprint, does any of that have to do with the counterterror fight?
I think to say that it has to do with the counterterror fight is too narrow, if that makes sense to you. There's a broad spectrum of capabilities that we bring to, like I said, to include disaster relief, to include partnering for non-commissioned officer education, to include training and crosstalk, and like I said, mutual relationships. I think to say that the counterterrorism piece is too narrow to say that's why we're increasing the footprint. It's much, much broader than that.
That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking with Command Sergeant Major Christopher Kepner. Somalia's President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo and Eritrea's President Isaias Afwerki wrapped up a two-day consultation meeting in Mogadishu today. The two presidents agreed to strengthen the two nations' historical relations through further cooperation in all areas of mutual benefit, including trade, investment, and people-to-people relations. Both presidents reaffirmed their commitment to enhance the momentum in the Horn of Africa cooperation with a focus on regional partnership for common development, progress, and prosperity. President Isaias said he welcomes and supports the Somali government's endeavor in establishing Somali-led security institutions that have the ability to provide the peace and security. Both leaders agreed to forge a strong relationship that would benefit the entire region. They noted that the effective regional cooperation is crucial for overcoming the common obstacles of insecurity, terrorism, poverty, and environmental degradation facing the region. Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, Zimbabwe's ruling party ZANU-PF is hosting its annual conference on the back of calls by the party's provincial structures to endorse Emmerson Mnangagwa as its presidential candidate in 2023, just 4 months after he was elected for the first time. VOA correspondent Addie Gondo has more.
Over 3,500 delegates have converged on the mining town of Eswatini after the ruling ZANU-PF Politburo meeting marked the start of the conference on Wednesday. Mnangagwa is headlining the proceedings following ratification of his leadership last year. Dr. Obed Mpofu, the party secretary for administration, said deliberations would ignore politicking and focus on pertinent issues.
He wants to do more than to spend time listening to things that are already, you know, being experienced by government.
Observers are raising questions over holding the conference at a time when the country's economy is suffering major upheaval, especially given the huge cost of transporting and hosting so many delegates. Thomas Stolle, a civic society actor, expresses his thoughts on the subject.
The conference serves nothing that is of benefit to the country. The conflation of state, party and government that has always been with the Zimbabwean state since its formation has not vacated the scene. So the resources obviously will come from government coffers, and we have seen the party benefiting from Zimbabweans who are paying taxes.
The current ZANU-PF government came to power on the back of hope for a so-called new dispensation. Observers say hopes of a new way of doing things under Mnangagwa are dim. One ordinary Zimbabwean, who spoke on condition of anonymity, says although the party is within its rights to host a conference, it owes Zimbabweans explanations.
So ZANU-PF should go to their Eskwedini Congress, but first they should tell Zimbabweans who is funding them to the tune of how much. We need to know the source of these funds. Who is funding ZANU-PF? Where is the money coming from? So if ZANU-PF is pushing for transparency and no true corruption, then you need to know the source, the fund. They need to be transparent about their systems. Then in that case, maybe the Muslims might trust them. And the people say this is a new dispensation, so we expect a new way of doing things.
Some see a lost opportunity for the ruling party to lead by example, given proposals for cost-cutting by the Minister of Finance that are weighing heavily on the public. Ranga Dzingai, a political analyst, shares his thoughts on the conference.
It comes after the government, through the finance minister, pronounced austerity measures which are painful to the ordinary Zimbabweans who is suffering in terms of the state of the economy. And one would question whether they are walking the talk by holding such an expensive exercise at a time they are talking of austerity, reducing government expenditure. And to me, reducing government expenditure and public expenditure is the same as also reducing party expenditure. It's really a challenge, and I think Zimbabweans are really examining as to the benefits of this kind of exercise.
Some commentators call ZANU-PF's conduct a case of old wine in new wineskins, pointing out that the government also recently pledged US$2 million on a fleet of high-end vehicles for cabinet ministers. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
Belgium has long struggled to deal with its colonial past, a period that saw millions of Africans in Congo and Rwanda die from disease, starvation, and violence. Now the country's Royal Museum for Central Africa, which once housed looted colonial treasures, including a human zoo, has undergone a five-year, $73 million revamp in an effort to show the reality of empire and of modern Africa. Henry Ridgewell reports from Brussels.
The Royal Museum for Central Africa opened in 1910 as a showcase for Belgian might and for the empire and the colonial riches it delivered. Museum director Guido Griesels says more than a century later, museum curators have attempted a complete reversal.
Our aim was to make a museum of contemporary Africa on the Africa of today, but at the same time to also bring a very critical look on the colonial past of Belgium. We recognize now the many victims of colonization, the African victims of colonization. We recognize too that there were a lot of the racist attitudes that were developed at that time have their consequences today.
Those attitudes are personified by a group of statues showing Africans as primitive and savage. They used to be dotted around the museum but are now grouped in the basement. Other artifacts have been given new captions explaining their provenance and displayed alongside modern African art. Videos offer African perspectives on culture, colonialism, and climate change. Not everything can be recast. Built into the walls are statues of Africans gazing adoringly at their white masters, with titles like Belgium Brings Well-being to Congo. The ornate grounds once housed a human zoo of more than 250 Congolese. Seven died from exposure to the cold after being forced to wear traditional dress. King Leopold II commissioned the museum to generate investment for mining and rubber production in the colonies. His name is synonymous with the brutality of empire. It is estimated that up to 15 million Congolese died through disease, famine and genocide. Mireille Tsiosi-Robert of the anti-racism organisation Bamko Cran argues the museum has not gone far enough in displaying the horrors of colonialism. Robert says that when the museum is not presented as a museum of colonisation, but instead as a museum of Africa, that really confuses the issue. Honestly, she says, we need to make a real museum of colonization. We need to deal with our colonial history. It is really something that is missing in Belgium. Then there is the question of where these treasures belong. Hundreds of thousands were looted. Director Grisils says he is open to returning stolen goods.
Well, certainly it's not normal that 80% of African art is in European museums or in European private collections. So we have to make sure that they can get much greater access to our collections. Congo at the moment lacks capacity to deal with a lot of that heritage.
Among those attending the opening this month was the director of Congo's museums, Paul Bakwalufu Badibanga. He insists any artifacts returned to his country would be secure.
Donc la sécurité, ça ne doit pas être un problème, un prétexte.
Badibanga says the issue of security is not a real problem. It is a pretext for not giving back the objects. The revamp of this famous institution has forced Belgium to confront its colonial past. Those behind the project say this is one more step on the long road to reconciliation. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the Museum of Africa, Brussels.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, condemns this week's eruption of violence against opposition rallies in the DRC. She's calling on authorities to prevent similar incidents from happening ahead of a crucial presidential election in 10 days. Lisa Shine reports from the High Commissioner's office in Geneva.
UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has expressed deep concern about the flare-up of violence in at least three provinces of the Democratic Republic of Congo. She says people have the right to freedom of expression and should be able to demonstrate peacefully and safely. Bachelet's spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, says the High Commissioner is calling for a prompt investigation into the violent events that have killed at least five people and injured many more.
The High Commissioner says she is deeply worried about the reports of excessive use of force, including live ammunition by security forces against opposition rallies. She's also concerned at reports of the use of inflammatory speech by political leaders.
Shamdasani tells VOA the government, in its defense, argues that those who support the opposition often carry out violent acts and the government has to respond.
However, this is no reason to use live ammunition against a mixed crowd of peaceful protesters and some who may be trying to carry out violent acts. At the end of the day, it's the government's responsibility to ensure that the use of force is very much limited to only situations where there is an imminent threat to the police or to the security forces.
The election on December 23rd will be the first time citizens of the DRC will go to the polls to elect a new leader since Joseph Kabila became president 17 years ago. Amid the backdrop of rising tensions, a fire broke out Thursday in an electoral commission building in the capital, Kinshasa, burning thousands of voting machines. Opponents accused backers of Kabila of setting the premises ablaze to postpone the election. A presidential advisor would not comment on what or who might have caused the fire, but said police guarding the warehouse have been arrested. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.